Welcome to Perspectives, a Canadian journal of political economy and social democracy. My name is Clement Nokos, editor of Perspectives Journal and director of policy and engagement at the Broadbent Institute. In case you missed it, earlier this April, we released the first issue of the Perspectives Journal, which you can now find online, and for those of you who attended the 2024 Progress Summit, we hope you could pick up a copy of our very limited print run of issue number one. In this episode, we'll listen to an interview with Nancy Fraser, renowned professor of philosophy and politics at the New School for Social Research in New York, who has written extensively on feminist theory and capitalism. She's interviewed by Nick Vlahos, deputy director at the Center for Democracy Innovation, and Adrian Bois, Marie Curie Sklodowska Fellow at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, ahead of their forthcoming co-edited special volume of the journal Democratic Theory that focuses on how to democratize the economy. This conversation explores Fraser's work on the crises of capitalism, democracy, and participation. She's argued that much scholarship in political science and democratic theory on these issues is hampered by, quote-unquote, politicism, an inclination to view the political in separation from other social spheres, which fails to appreciate the structural nature of contemporary crises. Fraser argues that the political arena is important because it is here that collective regulatory powers are exercised. However, it needs to be situated within a broader understanding of the social totality to understand how it is affected by crisis dynamics in other spheres and how it might contribute to attenuating or resolving these. The conversation begins by exploring these arguments in relation to Fraser's recent work on the critique of capitalism and then traces how this relates to her work on the public sphere, participatory parity, and utopian thought. Here's Nick Vlahos and Adrian Bois in conversation with Nancy Fraser.
So the first section we're interested in sort of unpacking is your thoughts on democracy and capitalism. So we're keen here about your reflections concerning the state about democracy and capitalism. And behind Marx's Kid in a Boat, you start with the statement that capitalism is back, and yet the current boom is largely rhetorical, a symptom of the desire for critique, but falling short of contributing to anything substantive. So maybe to start, where do you think the field is or academia is in terms of thinking about democracy and capitalism?
So I don't even remember the publication date of that first essay in New Left Review, which then became the first chapter of Countable Capitalism. But it's been quite a while. And I would say that during that the intervening years, I'm quite impressed with the amount of intellectual work and activism that has developed and that is taking on a kind of explicitly anti-capitalist frame. So not to say that, you know, this work has become intellectually hegemonic or that this political practice has you know, revolutionized the society, but it is a pretty impressive development because it's very integrative. I mean, people are, I think, really on a broad scale, people on the left are dissatisfied with a kind of single issue politics and thinking. And so, for example, theorists of democracy, I think, are increasingly interested in probing the relation between democracy and capitalism, because that's a tense relation. And the idea that we could somehow just put capitalism aside and develop all these beautiful normative ideals of how democracy should look becomes problematic if we don't understand the system that perverts and constrains and limits it.
So in the past, you've critiqued thoughts on solutions to the democratic crisis as politicists. Yeah, can you explain this concept a little bit?
Yeah, that was a term I believe I coined, unless I, without realizing it, read it somewhere else. But if I did, I have no idea where. I think I coined this term on analogy with economism, right? The idea of economism, which is an insult hurled usually at Marxists, although that I would argue that it's actually the sort of bourgeois thinkers who are the real economists, but all right, let's leave that aside. economism was the idea that, you know, the economic level, we can say the official economic level of society is, quote unquote, the base. Everything else is superstructure. And that's the thing you really have to look at. And if you just take care of getting that right, everything else will sort itself out as a matter of course, sort of epiphenomenally. Now, that is a very reductionist and vulgar idea, and I wouldn't defend it in any degree whatsoever. But I think a structurally analogous charge can be leveled against a lot of political science and political theory, which treats the political as if it were the base of everything, and could be abstracted out from the larger social totality, understood on its own terms, and then could be fixed on its own terms. We just need the right kind of procedure, the right kind of deliberative model, the right kind of electoral setup, right kind of parliamentary representation, right? All of those things that political scientists are concerned with, as if we could fix the political without paying attention to anything else. And in fact, once we fix the political, everything else will take care of itself because the political is, so to speak, the master instance of society. That is as reductive, as vulgar, as wrong as economism is or was. And I'm trying to say that what these spheres that we call the economy or the political, or if you want the state, these are in both cases absolutely integrated parts of a social totality. And in a social totality, a true totality in the Hegelian sense, you can't understand any part abstracted from the other parts. It's the relations of the parts that count. And so I would like to resituate the work of political science, the work of political theory, right, in a broader social theory, a critical theory of society that understands the way a capitalist economic organization, various family forms, various ways of organizing labor, and ways of organizing this domain that we call the political are all mutually co-constitutive, mutually defining and affecting.
A great analogy, and it's good to know that how you created that as a counterpart to economism. Is this level of politicism something you notice in democratic theory, or have you noticed it over time? Has this shifted towards this in the last several decades?
I have to say, first of all, that I'm trained as a philosopher and not as a political scientist. And I think that the way I've done work that would count as political theory, but I don't have that disciplinary perspective. Or if I have it, it comes from philosophy and not political science. So I'm probably less attuned to what, you know, goes on in the discipline of political science and political theory as a subfield of that than I should be. But I was struck by the importance of work I discovered, and some of which I discussed at least briefly, by the work of people like Colin Crouch, Wolfgang Streich, Wendy Brown. These were all people who were thinking politically in a way that was taking in what they thought of either as neoliberalism or as neoliberal capitalism. And in any case, they were very interested on, I mean, one way you could put it would be the impact of neoliberalization on democratic political forms, or maybe one could also speak vice versa. In any case, that work really struck me, and I tried to find a way of both appreciating the many insights that thinkers like that really developed, but also wanting to push it further and to say this is not just about neoliberalism. We really have to understand capitalism itself as a social totality that carves out a specific and relatively limited place for the political. And hence, the prospects for democracy are already quite limited within a capitalist society, even the most democratically inclined forms of capitalist society.
So does this level of politicism, I guess, not looking at the totality, does that limit the, you know, the field's ability, or I guess, you know, the field that you're thinking about in terms of its ability to diagnose crisis, the crisis of the times?
Yeah, that's a good angle on this that's quite revelatory, I think. There is a tendency to think that we live in a time of democratic crisis. Authoritarianism erupts everywhere, horrific right-wing populists and dictators and so on are elected and able to stay in power and so on and so forth throughout the world. And so we form the idea that democracy is in a crisis, as if this were a freestanding crisis. What I want to say is that a crisis in the political sphere cannot be disconnected from a crisis in the economy, from a crisis in social reproduction, from a crisis of ecology, that these are all today mutually interlinked expressions of a crisis of the whole social order. So I think it's a general crisis that we face today. It's true that there might be some periods in which we have sectoral crises in one or two spheres that are not metastasizing in the form of a general crisis. That can happen. I'm not saying it's impossible. But even there, when you get a sectoral political crisis, you can't understand it on its own terms. It needs to be understood as a situated development within a broader social totality that has crisis tendencies of various kinds and sometimes succeeds in softening some of those tendencies, displacing them onto other spheres and so on and so forth. So I think that all forms of crisis that we experience, including political crisis, democratic crisis, have their roots in the broader social totality of capitalist society. And I would like to trace the roots of our political crisis to crisis tendencies within that whole social formation.
I guess that kind of leads into, you know, future directions, forces of action. Where do you think the field needs to go then? Where, you know, where we should be, especially in thinking about how to trace those roots in terms of the social totality.
This is going to sound silly, but I just think people have to read more widely. The people who work in the political science, political theory, political analysis field have a lot of expertise. They know a lot of stuff. But if they allow themselves to sort of be contained within a disciplinary boundary, if they don't read political economy, if they don't read feminist theory, if they don't read ecological literature, and so on and so forth, and they're no worse off than anyone else. I mean, I think our intellectual life is organized in these siloed disciplinary fields, and everybody is trained in one of them and hired if one of them, if they're lucky enough to get a job at all, you know, and then this narrowing, the specialization sets in. And I think it's a constant struggle against that. And I just think one has to get out of your comfort zone and put yourself in positions where you're reading and talking to people who have other bodies of expertise. And in my career, the most exciting discussions have been those where people figure out how to connect, how to integrate across disciplines. I don't think there's any magic bullet, but we need spaces that and milieu that encourage this, organizations, conferences, journals, and so on that encourage this.
I think talking about that last answer about the pressures that placed upon academics to specialize, I think is an important reason why we can't sort of think more generally about the social order and make, as Marx would have said, a revolutionary fire out of looking at intersections, different sort of disciplines, right? In his case, German philosophy, French socialism, the British analytical tradition, etc. And I think the incentive structure of academia really militates against that. When I read your paper, Legitimation Crisis, it really did sort of hit a big bell went off in my brain when I read that, because I was sort of initiating my career in studying participatory and deliberative democracy, which I got into because of the sort of crisis moment that we were in. And I realized that we were sort of trying to democratize institutions. And there was a lot of very good work and very good knowledge around institutional design and process design and how to facilitate conversations to ensure sort of discursive equality. But it was sort of being channeled into the democratization of institution that I thought had quite little power. So this is one of the things we want to do in this edition, is to sort of channel that propositional capacity that democratic theory has towards more socially consequential areas of life. And I think your work's very important there, especially your work on the critical topography of the capitalist social order, which is what we're getting into now. So your work here is a really powerful depiction of the mutual imbrication, which is a word that you use a lot in your work, between the productive, socially reproductive, natural, let's say, and the political spheres, also sort of charting out their co-evolution and importance to how capitalism reproduces itself by sort of feeding upon these, and as you said in one of your answers before, sort of shifting crises between them. And David Harvey is quite good on this as well. I was going to ask you to briefly outline the topography, but since we've been talking about politicism and the lack of diagnosis of the political crisis, could we begin the topography by thinking of the political arena and how it's affected by the crises of capitalism, and then maybe move on from there?
What I said before about it not being freestanding when you have a political crisis is the key. And also, it's a mistake to just think that everything was fine and then went south with neoliberalism. I want to start with the proposition that by definition, every capitalist society institutes as a very fundamental feature of its structure, of its institutional design, a division or separation between market and state, if you like, between the economic, as we understand that in an official way, and the political, understood officially. And that's a boundary that is fraught with tension and attracts a great deal of jockeying and contestation and sometimes even outright struggle as what the relation. It's a field that makes a division and then has the problem of how they're going to relate, with a lot of different agendas and sets of interests and ideologies about how that should work. But the point is that the political capacities, governance capacities, ordering capacities, repressive capacities, all of these things are essential to the operation of the capitalist economy. You can't accumulate capital, you can't buy and sell, you can't secure property titles, right, without a legal system that, right, constitutes private property and the rules of exchange. You can't operate without regulatory capacities, and especially as capitalism develops historically and we get, you know, more used to the regularity, the frequency of depressions and stock market crashes and bouts of mass unemployment. And the idea then that the state has to do something here. It has to at least compensate for market failures. It has to figure out how to tide people over in severe downturns and maybe even be proactive in like figuring out how to prevent bad crises before it happens, break up monopolies or, you know, whatever. So the process of capital accumulation demands, it's not self-regulating. This was Polanyi's great insight, right? It's not self-regulating. It needs an external political force, kind of like Odysseus, tie me to the mask so that I don't, you know, engage in an orgy of self-destruction. So that's the argument that capital cannot live without. And I don't want to speak only of the state. but without public powers, because public power can operate at many different levels, from municipalities, as you both know very well, very local villages, nation states, regional powers, and in some cases, we actually have global powers that are supposed to be somewhat public, even if they're actually not elected by anybody. Okay, so we require a public power and public governance capacity. At the same time, capital is hardwired, is incentivized to weaken and elude those public capacities and public powers, to not pay taxes, to sustain them, to capture regulatory agencies, to offshore operations to weaker or nominal jurisdictions that barely do anything. In all these ways, it needs it, and it needs to weaken it. So this is already, I think, a permanent tension in any capitalist society, no matter where you draw the line between state and market, no matter how much you beef up one or weaken one, you're always going to face one version or another of this. And then you add to that, that it's a world economy and the political system is divided up into side-by-side states. And they're not all equal, of course. We have hegemons and client states and failed states and very weak states and so on and so forth. But still, we've got a lot of divided jurisdictions, yet the whole thing is supposed to be one flowing global space for business. So that adds a whole nother level of tension, because we have states trying at various points in history to secure their quote-unquote economy, their national champions, their, you know, industries, and so on. That's a more difficult prospect today. That's part of what neoliberalization means, is the relative weakening of state capacity vis-a-vis global investment flows, even with respect to relatively powerful states. But what I'm trying to describe is a relation in which capital depends on the political instance, but also is primed to try to evade and weaken it. And I think this adds up to a destabilizing tension at the heart of the social form, which periodically can erupt into an acute crisis. This does happen from time to time. And I think that that crisis, that eruption of political crisis at different moments historically in capitalism's history, can be part of a broader general crisis of the type I mentioned before, and of the type I think we are living in now, where it is only one strand of what we could call a crisis complex that also includes economic crisis, financial crisis, social reproductive crisis, ecological crisis, you name it. And when that happens, there's a very powerful, difficult problem, because you really need the political to fix those other things. And if the political, the governance capacities and ordering capacities are weakened and frayed, then they are actually incapable of addressing other crisis tendencies. And then that reacts back and creates more political chaos. Democracy doesn't work, right? We need a strong man. That's what would be one kind of response to what's experienced as government isn't able to solve our problems. And so this is a kind of a feedback loop almost. Anyway, that's there's a lot more I could say. I'll add one last point and then you can follow up. And that is, I think that these periods of general crises in the past, at any rate, have been resolved by the invention of a new form of capitalism, which organizes the relation of state and market, economy and polity in a somewhat different way, attempting to address problems of the previous phase, where an earlier way of relating the political and the economic has proved unable to contain the tensions and has unraveled, you could say. Then you get a new format, a new attempt, and that might work for a while to keep things under wraps. But because this tension is permanent, it's part of the institutional design of the setup. Because it's permanent, these fixes don't solve things in a definitive way. They postpone, they displace, they allow certain kinds of resolutions, but those generate new problems.
Firstly, you mentioned, well, the first question is perhaps sort of draw out a little bit more the other background features. You mentioned reproductive crisis and the climate collapse that we're having. But also you mentioned state capacity. And you also mentioned earlier that you've been influenced by Wolfgang Strick. This is someone who's written a lot about these themes around the inability, seeming inability, according to Strick, of the capitalist state to sort of even act in the long-term interests of capital in a sort of social democratic fashion. So there's an argument there about capitalism depleting the ability of public powers to actually do what's good for capital in the long run. And do you agree with that? Do you think we're at a point at which capitalism has sort of devoured the abilities of public power, of human agency to sort of imagine and enact, let alone an alternative social order, but even to sort of do what's bang capitalist heads together and then sort of do what's good for capital in the long run? Do you think we're at that point, or do you see some hope? And do you see some hope in participatory and deliberative democracy in terms of delivering that?
So I very much admire Strake's account of the unraveling of the sort of social democratic settlement, that the class compromise, the way of dividing, of activating, enhancing state regulatory power in the social democratic era for the sake of saving capitalism from the capitalists. I admire his account of the phases of its unraveling and the sort of stealth installation of neoliberalism as the next phase. And I do think that we are in a very severe situation right now. But I do have a disagreement with Strick. If I understand him, he actually thinks that it is possible to, in theory anyway, to put the global genie back in the national bottle. He thinks that maybe we could go back to something like national self-democracy, as a social democracy. We could get Germany could get back the mark and so on. I think that train has left the station. I don't think we're going back to any orderly form of tamed social democratic capitalism. We could end up in a very fragmented world of warlords and something very balkanized, so to speak, but this would not be a social democratic paradise. This would be a very ugly, everyone for themselves kind of story. But that doesn't mean I don't have hope. I mean, hope. It's not about empirical predictions. But let's put it this way. Capitalism has not destroyed human agency. It has destroyed the way in which that agency has been parceled up and organized in one institutional setup at one phase of its development. People have the agency that they've always had, but they can't exercise it unless we change the institutional design of the society. And above all, unless we disable this demonic drive to accumulate capital and appropriate profit as private property for the sake of more and more accumulation ad infinitum, ad nauseum. Unless we disable that driving, I don't know what to say, force at the heart of our society, I'm with Marx. I mean, that force has basically taken over our agency. It's the subject that stands against us and basically devours our agency for its ends, doesn't permit us to use that agency for our ends, or even to be able to imagine what our ends might be in a different system. It's not about making an empirical bet on what is likely, because I'm probably as pessimistic as anybody, given the way things look at right this moment. But I think that we're on such a collision course, we're on a path to oblivion. And what else can we do? I mean, I'm not willing to just go quietly into that night. What else can we do but try to, here I would use a phrase of Walter Benjamin, pull the emergency brake, right? Benjamin famously thought that, whereas Marx had thought revolution was the locomotive of history, Benjamin said, maybe we should think of it as pulling the emergency brake on the runaway train. It's not such a utopian image, but we're in such a dire situation that you have to adopt the Gramscian posture of optimism of the will, if pessimism of the intellect. And in theory, there are ways of doing things differently that could avert all of this. There are. The problem is, how do we get there from here, given the amount of political insanity that is rampant in the world, and given the power of the forces against us? And I don't just mean the fascist or proto-fascist political leaders. I mean, you know, the power of Apple and Google and Citibank and Goldman Sachs and so on and so forth.
Just quickly before I hand over to Nick, maybe you could just give a brief overview of this mutual imbrication between the different spheres.
Basically, the same account I just gave you of this sort of perverse contradictory relationship between dependence and division, dependence and disavowal. That was essentially how I was characterizing, not in so many words, the relationship between economy and polity. I would say that same relation, I think of these as the D words, right? That capitalism divides production from reproduction. It divides exploited so-called free labor from expropriated unfree labor. It divides, in that sense, the core from the periphery, even though that's quite scrambled today and not the way it used to be. It divides human society from non-human nature. These are all divisions that are institutionalized within the design of a capitalist society. And I don't think nothing can count as a capitalist society that doesn't have one version or another of these divisions. But these are divisions that mask dependencies. Capital requires unwaged care work to maintain its labor supply. It requires expropriated unfree labor to make free exploited labor profitable. It requires the construction of nature as a field of a tap and a sink, and just stuff we can take with, don't have to bother to replenish or repair, you know, what we do. Capital depends on all those background conditions, just like I said earlier, it depends on political preconditions as well. And in these other cases too, it disavows its dependence. It doesn't pay the costs of social reproduction. It doesn't pay the costs of ecological reproduction. It doesn't obviously pay even the reproduction costs of unfree labor, which it expropriates on a massive scale globally. So here too, we have tendencies, contradictions. You depend on something that you are basically at the same time incentivized to trash. And over time, that is a formula for instability and just, you know, crisis waiting to happen. So the same logic of built-in tendency to political crisis operates in the spheres of social reproduction, nature, and let's say the geography of labor free and unfree. So I'm basically suggesting that there are at least these four structural dispositions to crisis that are in the DNA of a capitalist society. And that opens up trade-offs, displacements among them, and then the possibility of rare moments in which they all become acute at once and exacerbate one another, like in the present.
Right. So it's a really powerful depiction. And at the beginning, you mentioned the importance of the political in terms of being the sphere through which our agency operates, public powers, and the one through which we might be able to sort of resolve or have a more harmonious relationship with these background conditions.
Yeah. So, I mean, it fits nicely, I think, with what you recently, what you were just, you know, depicting, specifically as it overlaps with your concept of justice. You know, you've had a lot of, you know, rich exchanges, you know, in the New Left Review quite some time ago with Iris Marion Young, and I'm sure it's carried forward, you know, in your recent writings. So, like, the concept of participatory parity represents an important normative orientation. Can you describe what you mean by participatory parity?
Look, at one level, this was an intervention in philosophical debates of the time about the theory of justice. And, you know, so in the United States and in the Anglophone world more broadly, there was a period of starting the 70s, 80s, 90s of tremendous creativity and so on, a lot of it in analytic philosophy. The debates between Rawls and Nozick and Sen and Dworkin and so on, Elizabeth Anderson. These are all really great figures within this somewhat narrow area, although it's not that narrow. Anyway, I followed all of those debates, and I also was struck by the developing split within the left in the US and elsewhere between the so-called social left and the so-called cultural left. Not that these terms are exactly the right terms, or as I thought of them, the politics of redistribution and the politics of recognition. And I thought that that whole split, by the way, was another sort of way in which capitalist structural splits were reflected in how we thought about justice in a way that was problematic, that these, as if there were two different spheres and two different kinds of justice and so on. So I started out by arguing that you couldn't have real egalitarian redistribution without real egalitarian reciprocal recognition and vice versa. So that it wasn't about, you know, which was right, the cultural left versus the social left, that a left had to integrate all of this in a broader conception of justice. Then I developed the idea that maybe that broader conception couldn't be that the arguments about how to think about distributive justice were not adequate in this broader frame. So I developed this idea of parity of participation, the idea being that a just society was one in which there were no distributive barriers or recognition barriers, and then later I added representation barriers to full participation on terms of parity with your fellows in society. So that was the idea. It was meant to bring together ideas of distributive justice, ideas of recognition, and ideas of equal representation or equal political voice together under one framework. However, I soon found that it was necessary to distinguish what I called first order participation from meta participation. And this gets us directly into the political end of things, meaning it wouldn't be sufficient to say that, you know, we had a just society when everyone could participate on terms of parity in the economy, in social reproduction, in, you know, in here and in there. But there was also this question of the meta design of the whole, right? Which forms of participation do we want to even have in our society? Should they be separated institutionally from one another or not? How do you deal with their interactions with each other if we're thinking about different spheres of participation, different spheres of social action? So I soon found, again, that I had to really think a lot more about the political, because as you say, that the political is the sphere, I jotted this down, in which our agency operates. Well, it's not exactly right, because our agency operates in all spheres, but the political is the sphere by which we reflect, or we should be reflecting on the whole. And so there we have a kind of meta-agency, or an agency about agency, a participation about participation. That's what I think is special about the political. But again, if we accept the delineation of these spheres and arenas of participation that we are given in a capitalist society, what have we done? We've basically outsourced that meta capacity for reflection on the whole that is so important. We've outsourced that to the capitalist class because it's their investment decisions geared, again, to this infernal spiraling of profit beyond profit beyond profit. They are basically in charge of how everything develops, the shape the whole takes. And that we have to take back from them.
If substantive social and economic equality is needed to enhance participatory and a deliberate system of public discourse, have we moved closer to bracketing as opposed to eliminating inequality? Like how does participatory parity relate to democratizing the economy?
Well, that very distinction between bracketing social inequality and trying to deliberate as if we were peers when in fact we're not, that distinction between that and actually eliminating those parity impeding inequalities, that was central to my work on the public sphere, my reflections on Habermas in the public sphere. And I basically think that liberal democracy is premised on the idea that you can simply bracket those things, meaning pretend they don't exist, and we act as if we are equal, or our political system is designed as if we are equal when the whole society is organized so that we cannot possibly be equal. So this is, again, another contradiction, so to speak. And that's why many people intuit this problem and, right, think that there's some other kind of democracy beyond liberal democracy that can better deal with that. So we have people talking about radical democracy or deliberative democracy or participatory democracy. And I think that impulse is a good impulse. The problem is to make good on that impulse, as I was saying before, requires not simply trying to make democracy better within its assigned sphere of decision-making and institutions, but to actually democratize the larger project of deciding things like where you're going to draw the line between a state and a market, assuming you still are going to have some markets somewhere, which I assume we would, maybe not at the levels and of the sort we have now. I would distinguish between democracy within a pre-delimited sphere that leaves many very consequential and pressing decisions outside the political sphere, and the democratization of social societal design in the broader sense of sphere making or domain making, as the legal theorists, they talk about redomaining and all that kind of stuff. I'm for deliberative democracy and participatory democracy, but the question is within what? Which processes and decisions are going to be subject to that form of social decision making, and which are left to, armies or bankers or whatever, who have nothing to do with it, with that kind of process?
So in the symposium that we edited, we make the argument that, as you've said, participatory deliberative democracy is perhaps focused too much on government institutions and has been reticent to engaging with the economy in the sort of traditional way of thinking about the economy in terms of production, distribution, and exchange, but also in terms of how the economy relates to these background conditions of possibility for capitalism. And we argue that a critical political economy focus can provide a sort of, let's say, structural compass that can direct the energies, the reforming energies of participatory deliberative democracy towards more powerful institutions. Now, I think it was in a New Left Review article in 2012 on justice, I believe. Forgive me if I'm wrong, where I think you, if I remember correctly, you make an argument for the value of pure critique. Now, one of the issues that at least I find with critical political economy is that it's very sort of critique laden and can kind of lead to a kind of propositional sort of paralysis, I think is the term that we use in the edition. So do you think it is important to move beyond critique? What is the value of pure critique? And if you do think it's important to move beyond critique, how do you think that participatory and deliberative democracy can help us do that as we think about democratizing the economy and its relationship with its background conditions?
Great question. And I have to say, I don't recall defending the value of pure critique, but I may well have. So let's not worry about that. So look, I think that there are partly a division of labor within that larger conversation that I was describing at the outset that transgresses disciplinary boundaries. We should also transgress boundaries between pure critique and, you know, whatever the other whole of that is, pure visionary thinking. These things have to be in conversation, clearly. I become, I guess, a professional critic. This is what I know how to do, what I figured out how to do. And by contrast, I've done very little myself that you could describe as imagining desirable alternatives, if that's the right contrast term. Actually, very, very recently, I wrote something I taught and was so impressed by William Morris that I wrote something about William Morris and emancipated labor. And he's one of those few thinkers who combines a very hard-headed Marxian critical political economy of capitalism with a feel for art and nature and new ways of living. And so that I was really inspired because there's so few people who can bring those two things together. And too much of the visionary is disconnected from the critical. And then it becomes that dreaded anti-Hegelian figure of the pure ought and so on. So that's one piece of the picture. The other piece is how change happens through social struggle, organized in movements, in unions, in political parties, in all the various organizational forms in which people undertake radical action for deep structural emancipatory social change. What inspires them? It can't just be that things are terrible, although I wouldn't discount that things are bad, but also some kind of inspiration, some sort of sense that there is an alternative. And what is it that makes a particular alternative seem not just feasible, but really desirable? And so I think that real change making necessarily has to have this visionary utopian dimension. That doesn't mean that I'm in a position to supply that. I sort of know what skills I have at present, and I'm not sure those are among them. But I read a lot of fiction. I think film, fiction, there just are places where the dry forms of theory and critique take on some flesh. And possibly the justice article that you were referring to in New Left Review was the one about Ishiguro. Is that what you were referring to about Never Let Me Go? I don't know, maybe not. But I did, that's one of the few things I ever wrote about fiction. And like I say, this thing on...
Yes, I believe you're right. Yes, yeah. It was a while ago, but I believe you're right.
Yeah. Anyway, there's no question that these are two things that are unfortunately too separated from each other, critique and imagination of alternatives. And I think we need both individual thinkers who are good at imagining alternatives, and also there's no real substitute, though, from the creativity that people engaged in social movement generate in this direction. That's the best I can do on that, I think.
I don't want to leave us hanging with you thinking that you've done little in desire in imagining desirable alternatives. Far from it. I mean, in rethinking the public sphere, I think you've really, if anything, advanced the way we think about alternatives, not just thinking about single public spheres, but counter publics. You know, you talked about social struggle, but the different forms of counter publics and how they should operate. And, you know, in advancing, you know, our your vision of, you know, the different sort of hidden abodes and how we should think about the economy and the way the political sphere should be actually, you know, so important to thinking of and reimagining, you know, how these are integrated and connected. I
Thank
just want to
you.
thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me add one point, because I didn't even remember this, but it's true that the last chapter of Cannibal Capitalism is a kind of very, very preliminary, almost primitive and exploratory attempt to say something about what an expanded view of socialism would be that could constitute an alternative to the very perverse expanded capitalism that we have now. So I've made a foray here or there. It's true. Okay, thank you for reminding me.
That was Nick Vlahos and Adrian Bois in conversation with Nancy Fraser on her work exploring the crises of capitalism and democracy for the forthcoming special volume of the journal Democratic Theory. If you like this conversation, share and subscribe to Perspectives, Canadian Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, on all major podcast platforms, as well as Press Progress's Sources podcast that digs deeper into the news stories you won't find in the major papers. The Perspectives Journal podcast and Sources are proud members of the Harbinger Media Network, Canada's progressive podcast community. You can read more in Perspectives Journal, a publication of the Broadbent Institute, by visiting perspectivesjournal.ca.